Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show. And if you're listening, you must be on your computer because we are live streaming right now. Tell all your friends who might be listening to a broadcast signal normally to tune in to KRFY.org and listen to us live streaming. You don't want to miss this. It's going to be a really good show, right, Julie?
It's really true, Phil. It's Halloween week, and have we got the topic for it?
Yeah, before we get that, have you done anything yet to celebrate Halloween? A lot of ghouls and goblins were out this weekend.
Well, it's true. There have been a number of parties. I haven't been to one yet, and you know what? I've got to tell you, I'm having trouble with my costume this year. I want to do something different, and it's confounding me, yeah. So it'll be another trip to the thrift store for me.
I went rummaging through a couple thrift stores and antique shops, and I've come up with something. I'm not going to say what, because you'll see probably Thursday night.
No, don't tell. No, we don't want there to be 10 of you running around Sandpoint
week. There won't be 10 of this. I guarantee you this will be unique.
Have you been doing
anything else fun?
A little pickleball. I think you knew about that. It's the time for transitional seasons. It's the shoulder season where we're not sure what to do. And for me, it's been pickleball.
Indoor pickleball?
Indoor pickleball.
Indoor pickleball.
Yeah,
it's a little indoor pickleball. Most of the week and part of the weekend at the National Wilderness Workshop.
Neat.
Which was a whole lot of fun.
I'll bet. In Bend, you said.
In Bend, Oregon, yes.
Very neat. And you had good, hopefully good results and learned a lot.
Oh, yeah. Good networking. Always a great opportunity to network with peers and colleagues. And in a place like Bend, it's very conducive to that because of all the breweries.
Oh, very much so. That does lend itself to networking.
And speaking of national celebrations, this is National Bat Week.
Well, yes, it is, and that will lead us into our topic, but it's another week, too, or another day, actually.
What day is it?
I don't know if cats and bats get along very well. I have a feeling they don't, but isn't it International Cat Day?
I think it's National Cat Day. At least Canada celebrates in August, and the U.S., we do it on October 29th.
All right, well, we'll say National Cat
Day.
But
my cats would say every day should be National Cat Day.
Well, I should think so. Cats are pretty self-important at times.
Well, let's touch on the weather for those who are interested in going outside. As Julie mentioned, it's a transitional season, and today it's going to be sunny, although, boy, it woke up awfully cold and dark.
Yes.
We're going to hit a high just above freezing today, 33 degrees. The low tonight is a balmy 12 degrees, at least predicted.
That's chilly, Phil.
Yep. And this continues tomorrow, high of 38, inching up a little bit, low of 16. Thursday, a little warmer, 42 and 20, but really it feels more like it's the first part of winter.
Yes, it does. It feels very winterish today, a little early for that, in my opinion.
I think a lot of animals might be thinking about migrating or hibernating, and we're going to talk a little bit about what bats do here. And we've talked about bats. I guess the beans are out of the bag. Today's show is about bats. And with us in the studio today, we have Carrie Hugo, wildlife biologist for Coeur d'Alene Field Office of the Bureau of Land Management, and Diane Probasco, a U.S. Forest Service biologist. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah,
and just so listeners can know who's who, Carrie, say hello.
Hi, this is Carrie.
And Diane.
Hi, this is Diane.
All right. Well, we'll try to keep it straight. And hi, I'm Julie. With three female voices, it may be a little complicated.
I hope you can tell mine apart.
Well, we have the two guests, Phil, but we've got a third guest that no one's mentioned, and that guest is dressed for Halloween.
Oh, he's in here, isn't he?
Tell us about him.
So I have my little dog, Healer. He is dressed as a bat to celebrate National Bat Week.
We'll probably try to get a photo of that up on Facebook or something later because it doesn't translate to the airwaves real well. But
I think so.
It is a very darling costume. Julie, maybe you could find something like that and go with Dexter on
Halloween. Give away my ideas, Phil. Come on, I'm working on that. But actually, there is another little guy in the studio, but he has to be in the back studio because he's sort of noisy. And that's Dexter, and Dexter's dressed as a bat today, too, all in honor of Bat Week and our guests this morning. So
why don't we delve in? Tell us a little bit about yourselves, your background, what you do as a wildlife biologist in relation to bats. Diane, let's start with you.
So I've worked with bats for about 19 years now. And I started with the Forest Service. And my interest became in bats with doing from caving. Ooh. So learned a lot about bats and caves and cave environments and how they relate. And then that transferred into my position, and I've just built off of it over the years.
Well, which came first, the bats or your degree? Were you already studying biology, or was this something you've enjoyed since even earlier times?
Oh, I've enjoyed the outdoors since early times. Grew up shouldn't say this, but without cell phones or a lot of internet. And so we would go out and find holes to go into that we later found out were like bear dens and things like that. And so I've always been crawling into small spaces, I guess.
Oh, my goodness.
Lots of interesting things. And way back when, saber-toothed tigers and things.
Oh, at least I'm not that old.
So, Carrie, tell us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in bats.
I got interested in bats when I was working with the Fish and Wildlife Service in New Mexico. And New Mexico is one of the two states with the highest numbers of bat species. So diversity-wise, very cool. And I had a mentor who took me traipsing all around New Mexico to try to capture or record Allen's big-eared bat, or Allen's lappet-eared bat, which hadn't been documented in a few decades. We never did find one, but we had a lot of fun trying to find them. And I got to work with the two nectar-feeding bats down there that are listed as threatened that give us tequila.
Now, Allen's bat isn't a person's bat. It's the name of a species, right?
Yeah, okay. Correct. Yep. And they have huge ears. Really cool. I really wish we could have
Do we have them up here?
No. Oh. Sadly, no. But we have a similar bat in appearance, the Townsend's big-eared bat, which has massive ears also.
All right. And they're not, they're maybe threatened, the Allen's bats, or just not?
They don't have any official listing with the Fish and Wildlife Service. Mm. A lot of times it's because there's not a lot known about them, so we don't know if populations have declined or by how much. So
I see.
They sit there being a mysterious bat that people want to find but don't encounter
very
often.
That's the case with a lot of animals, especially those that come out at night and may not make a whole lot of noise, and flying squirrels come to mind, one of the other flying mammals. We'll talk about that in a bit, but we're finding out more about bats. Kind of give us a thumbprint of the current state of knowledge about bats. Is it good? Is it getting better?
It's getting better. Carrie and I were just talking about it on the way up here, as far as there's still not a lot known about bats. We still have a lot of mysteries, a lot of holes in our knowledge for bats. You know, what population-wise, things like that, we don't have a good handle on that. And when I started, there was, and Carrie, you know, we were learning from mentors, you know, learning by experience, learning through that way. And over the years, and especially actually with white nose syndrome that started back east, we've seen a huge expanse of knowledge in bats and a whole bunch of new research coming out. So we're still learning stuff every day.
But a crisis like that leads to some funding, and that probably has helped with research.
So let's start with some basic things, what we know and we don't know, because there are a lot of myths about a lot of animals, but particularly it seems the bats have attracted a lot of myths over the bird over the years. You know, the basic one being, they're not birds, are they?
No.
I know.
So they're mammals. They have the largest of all the mammals. They're the largest group of mammals, and so there's about 1,300 species of bats, and about 160 are fruit bats, and the rest are insectivores. So eating insects, and you know the smallest is about the size of a bumblebee, which it's called the bumblebee bat, and the largest is the golden-crowned flying fox with a 6-foot wingspan.
Oh my!
That sounds regal.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, if you think and look at your hands, that's what makes up their wings. So your thumb, all the way through your fingers are the bat wings. So unlike a bird, the bats are flying with their hands, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then their tail membrane makes up their legs. Mm. So, but they are mammals. They have live young. And yeah.
And they're the only mammal that has adapted to fly, true flight in a mammal.
Yeah, the flying,
as you mentioned, we have flying squirrels and sugar gliders and things like that that do glide, but they don't actually fly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And bats are also really not like mice. They're not like a little rodent, are they?
No, not at all. As Carrie mentioned earlier, they developed from shrews, and which aren't mice either.
No.
You know, to me, if you look at all the 1,300 species of bats, They all have very different faces. Some look a little bit more cat-like to me. Some of them look like puppy, little flying puppy dogs. You know, there's a whole bunch of different looks to them.
I know there's, for a lot of people, an immediate ooh factor. But mm-hmm. but really, when you see photos of them or see them up close and personal, they do look kind of cute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're adorable.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm biased.
We have some bias going on in the room. Yeah,
but just a little.
And they're not like mice in that they don't reproduce like four times a year, do
they? I was just going to say that. That's one of the big distinguishing differences between bats and rodents is rodents tend to be prolific oftentimes, especially like deer mice as an example. They can have probably 9 litters, I think I read, in a year of 4 to 9 offspring. Whereas bats, one of the reasons that the alarm bells go off with bat population declines is that they're very slow reproducers. They have 1 to 2 pups.
So pups. A year. I was pups. Just going to say, let's talk about the babies. They're called pups.
Before that, though, I've got one last question about bats in general. And what is the longevity of bats? Is it varied? Longer than mice, though, I would guess.
A lot longer than even I knew. I was doing some Googling before I came because I thought these questions might come up. And the oldest bat ever recorded was a little brown bat captured in New York that was 34 years and 8 months old.
Wow.
Yeah, so life. Another very significant difference between bats and rodents.
That's a long time. Now, I thought Count Dracula lived to 900 years. you tell me he's not part of the bat family.
No. There are vampire bats, though. So, but they don't suck blood and they don't turn into...
And they're not all from Transylvania.
No. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the vampire bats. So, people, let's bust that myth right now. Tell us the real low-down skinny on vampire bats.
Well, vampire bats, they're fascinating to me. They do cause a lot of issues in some of the South American countries. They come up as far as Mexico. Every once in a while, we'll see one dive into Arizona, but not very often. And so vampire bats, they actually have heat sensors so they can detect mammals and they can go in and they actually bite. Hmm. And their saliva allows them to, for the blood not to coagulate. But blood is also not very nutritious. So they actually have to gorge on the blood so much of like cattle and horses and occasionally people, but very rarely because we'll feel it and wake up and move. But they'll drink that blood, but then they actually have on their elbows, they actually walk away from their, because
they're so full they can't fly.
Exactly.
Oh my.
So it takes a little bit for them to absorb that and be able to fly. The only problem is some of those especially go after like the heels of cattle and the ears of horses, and then you can get a little infection. So that's where they become a problem.
I see.
So are they related to the chupacabra?
Yeah. Yeah, but they're less mythical.
It's Halloween week. We have to bring up some of the mythical creatures. Yeah. Uh-huh. I do want to talk more about the baby bats, though. If they're not as prolific as mice, but they seem to do well when they have big colonies, talk to us about the longevity, how long it takes for the pups to leave the nest. How they fare, how they learn to fly. Walk us through the life of a pup.
Well, baby bats, like I mentioned earlier, oftentimes it's one pup. They're called pups per mother. And they, around here, they're born in June, June-ish. And they can fly within 2 to 3 weeks, which is, I think, pretty cool. That's
pretty fast.
Yeah, I would have thought it would take a little longer. I was thinking like eagles, you know, they take a long time. But they nurse still off their mother's milk till they're about around 30-ish days, 25 to 30 days old. So for myself, and I know for Diane as well, when we do bat surveys, which entails putting up nets called mist nets and capturing them typically when they're coming out of a roost or they're over water, we don't do surveys until August or September, somewhere in there, because you don't want to keep mothers away from their pups and you don't want to overstress. Newly volant is the term for baby bats that can now fly and leave the roost. So once they're volant, you still don't want to be catching them on their first bad experience coming out of the roost. So we tend to be more sensitive to waiting till they're a little older.
So if they're only producing one offspring at a time and one per year, that's pretty actually slow reproductive rate. Mm-hmm. Their longevity must be good. How do they fare versus the predation that might exist on them?
Well, bats are susceptible to predation. I don't think that's a primary cause of any population declines you might see. More so in population declines would be perhaps disease like white nose syndrome or destruction of roosts, loss of foraging habitat, either through habitat changes or pesticide use, things like that. But that slow reproductive rate is a huge concern for biologists and should be for people in general, because by the time we detect a change in a bat population, it's already kind of a red flag and a four alarm scenario, because it will take them quite some time to recover.
Right. You know? Slow recovery with that kind of reproduction.
It's not unlike a grizzly bear. You know, grizzly bears have really low reproductive rates, and so a decline there.
Grizzly bears are frightening enough without flying around at night. Yes. If we want to really infuse some Halloween week nightmares.
Yes, let's not connect those two together. Good point, yeah. Really going to be scared, Phil. Goosebumps.
I think probably everybody knows, but let's talk about it anyway. They are night specialists, bats, that is. And one of the amazing things is how well they fly at night. Mm-hmm. Walk us through that.
Are they entirely night or some daytime dwellers?
There are some daytime dwellers. We don't have any daytime dwellers here in this part of the world. Idaho does not have any of those, even though you might occasionally see them out during the day, flying around, especially when they're migrating. Every once in a while, you'll see them flying. But in general, none of the insectivorous bats are daytime flyers. So a lot of the fruit-eating bats, some of the nectar bats, will be out during the day, and flying foxes and things like that will be out. And those are kind of fun that way to see. But they are. And that's, you know, one of the things when we were talking earlier, the myth of how did they become associated with Halloween? And that is because they're kind of that in-between species. And Halloween is all about being in between, the in between between life and death, in between winter and fall, or fall and winter, I should say. And that's, so bats being that in between, which help me with the
liminal.
Liminal.
Yes.
Means in between. Mm-hmm. And so we're, and that's how they became associated, because they do live in that in between and the caves.
So I've seen them at night. We have some on our deck, a colony that lives up in the eaves. And to me, the most amazing thing is that they seem to go from sleep to 60 in like 3 seconds. They drop out before they hit the deck. They're flying, and then they somehow miss the plate glass and all of the branches and stuff outside the deck. As if they can see, but they don't do it through sight. It's echolocation?
Well, they have echolocation, but they actually don't have bad sight either. Mm. They can actually see almost as good as you and I. They just have different,
rods and cones or something.
Thank you.
So they have, rods and cones. They have good night vision.
They do actually have good night vision. Mm-hmm. And then their echolocation makes the world visible to them by sound.
And they're tracking down these mosquitoes in the middle of the night, thank God. I praise them.
Yes, we all do.
They seem to do a good job. Yes.
But back to their sort of mythical qualities, and there's so many things about them that are sort of between this and that. They're kind of between a bird and a mammal, and they're between night and day, and you know, they're just so unusual to those of us who don't see them all the time. And they do make a great Halloween symbol. Mm-hmm. They do.
So tell us about the bats in our area.
So we have 13 different species, if I remember right. Or
14. In Idaho.
Thank you.
Yep. Up here, 11.
Yes, our area does include, we have listeners in Montana, British Columbia, and even live streaming Minnesota and Colorado.
Yes, we do.
But For the sake of this argument, let's say the northern panhandle of Idaho. Yes,
but 11 up here and 14 in the state, that's a lot of bat species.
There are. Most of them are small. So most of them are what we are in the Myotis family. So there, you know, we have quite a few that are Evolans, and they have different structures, different ears. And their ears and their the little piece that, if you think about our ear, that is hangs out there is the targus in bats, and that helps with that echolocation. And so does the nose structure. Any of those things we've figured out help with how bats see the world. And so most of all ours are insectivores. And the hoary bat is our largest bat, and it roosts in leaves and trees and roosts in the back of bark. And then the smallest is called a western pipistrelle. And we have some of those that they're more canyon dwellers and more into the rocks and that type of thing.
Is it true that one of them is the smallest bat in North America? Is that true?
That would be the western pipistrelle, which we don't have up here, but southern Idaho have them. They're kind of more of an arid.
And so they're very social creatures. The ones we see are in colonies of 40 to 60 individuals in a space that's so small. It's barely wider than your hand and maybe 12 inches deep and 14 high. And yet 40, 50, 60 bats will fall out of there any given night.
Yeah, I was actually in doing a little research in preparation for the show. I was looking up vampire bats, and there was an interesting video online that was talking about, you know, what is the value of vampire bats? Because there are parts of the world where they just would like to exterminate them. Because if you think about it, they don't provide, you know, you can say insectivores provide an ecosystem service that benefits humans because they reduce pests, whatnot. But vampire bats, not so much. But one of the ways that they actually try to exterminate them is by putting poison on their backs. Mm. And because they're so social, it spreads throughout a colony very quickly because they groom each other. They cuddle. I mean, they cuddle. They're very social animals.
Let's talk a bit more about the social qualities of bats, because I think of bats as sort of a lone animal flying around eating insects and doing its own thing, but it's really not true, is it? They like each other. They have...
So we do, like our little brown bat, it'll be in colonies back east, in colonies of 2,000, 3,000, 20,000. Mm-hmm. And that's why we saw so much with white noses. We saw those colonies drop to zero. Mm-hmm. Out west, we have much smaller colonies. And they, you know, we do have maternity colonies that will range into the thousands. But most of them are closer to, you know, 100 or 200. And then some species like the, big brown and the... Townsend big-eared bat, they're a little less social. So unless they're in the maternity colonies, they tend to be one-on-one. Hmm. And different times, bats will be more social than other times. So this time of year, when they're swarming to go into some of their winter roosts or preparing for some migrations, they'll get into bigger groups and will fly together. So we'll see swarms. Maternity colonies will also see in together. Their pups will cluster, and so they go in together, and they mom can come in, and by smell and sound she'll find her pup be able to nurse, and then they'll all cuddle together for warmth,
which is pretty astounding when you think of these Mexican free-tailed bats that have roosts of 10 million bats, and thinking of a mother bat coming back in and finding her pup out of all of those millions of babies.
It was amazing. Really cold last night, and that's not unusual in the fall. We get some cold snaps, and this must induce one of these behaviors, migration or hibernation. Which do they do? Is it different for different species?
It's different for different species. Each species does a little bit different, and some we just don't know. There's some species we don't know whether they migrate or hibernate. We haven't been able to find out what it is.
So they just disappear.
The bats on our deck, we see spring, summer, early fall, and then they disappear. We don't know if they go into the woods and hang out there, higher up, lower down on the mountain, or to Mexico.
Well, most likely you're most likely seeing little brown bats. They're probably the most common in our area. And we know that they do hibernate. And we don't know if the ones here migrate or just stay here and find caves in buildings and things like that to stay in. Or some of them actually do head down south. And when I say south, I'm not talking Mexico, just down southern Idaho into parts of Utah. And they'll go into some of those, like craters.
Craters of the Moon.
Craters of the Moon is a beautiful one. We've talked over there that how some of those migrations actually probably come down from Yellowstone down into craters and hibernate down in there.
Mm-hmm. But do they all hibernate, or do some just migrate and continue eating? Do they all hibernate?
We have a couple of known long-distance migrants, and that would be the silver-haired bat and the hoary bat. Those are our two foliage roosters, and they go down to Mexico, Texas, maybe as far as Central America. I'm not quite sure, but I know they go quite a distance.
And then they don't hibernate.
They go down there to hibernate.
Oh, they do. Mm-hmm. So they all hibernate, just in different places.
Well, I'm not sure if all hibernate, but those two species do. Okay. They're just going somewhere farther south to find their hibernation spot.
And when they stay here, do they hibernate where they've raised their young, or do they find a different spot?
It depends.
So much depends.
I know. That's our favorite word as biologists.
And I really want to know, and maybe we know, maybe we don't, but I'm going to ask you guys, because if anyone does. So they don't look like they'd be able to store enough body fat to sleep through the winter, but they somehow do. Do they sleep upside down, hanging up like in the summer, all winter long?
They do. They actually, their feet. So for us, if we clench our fists, we get tired. But for bats, that's their relaxed state. Hmm. So if they're clenched and hanging, that's actually relaxed. Hmm. So they can fall asleep and go into a form of hibernation called a deep torpor. And they go down in there, all their systems, they don't shut down like a true hibernator, but they slow down. But it takes a ton of energy for them to wake up and go back to sleep. So if they do that too often, like if we go into a lot of caves or disturb them during the middle of winter and during their hibernation cycle, or what we found with white nose is the skin membrane dehydrates, so they get up and it's irritating, so they groom themselves. And then that waking up and going down wastes all that energy.
Well, that phenomena was, I think, the source, cause, reason for the study Julie uncovered over the weekend, the fat bat study, which you're probably familiar with. Our listeners may or may not be. So real briefly, researchers, I think in Michigan, attempted to feed bats very well before they went into hibernation by attracting moths with UV lights, with the premise that the fatter the bat, the more likely they would be able to survive a sudden wake up from white nose syndrome. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
And I haven't seen the results completely out of that study, if they've found that it's worked or not. The only issue that I can see with that, and maybe they found a way around it, is bats have a very slight difference in how much they can eat and still be able to fly. So just like the vampire bat, if it gets too heavy, it can't fly. Even that's one reason we have a hard time actually researching bats, is because the GPSs, it's not as much the GPS technology, it's the battery life of seeing how they go. Because you can't weigh down the bat too much, because otherwise it will die during flight.
So much more to talk about. We're going to take a short music break just so we can all catch our breaths and ponder more about bats. We're going to take a pause for a couple minutes, listen to a little bit of Peter, Paul, and Mary, and then we're going to be back. There's so much more to add. Leatherwing bat.
Perfectly appropriate for today's topic.
Perfect song for the day. And if you're just tuning in, this is KRFY 88.5. FM in Pendre, listener-supported community radio for all of North Idaho and our bigger, broader region.
That's right. It's the Tuesday live Tuesday morning show.
And we're talking bats in honor of National Bat Week this week with Carrie Hugo, wildlife biologist from the Coeur d'Alene Field Office of the BLM, and Diane Probasco, U.S. Forest Service biologist. Welcome back to the show. Let's pick up on some of the stuff we were talking about just before we left, and I think it moves towards the question of habitat. Where do bats live when they're not in the southern part of Idaho, nesting in a cave or up on a deck in an eave? What's their natural habitat around here?
Well, those are some of their natural habitats, though. We have some caves around here. Yeah. We have some, we definitely have some decks and some old buildings and old barns. Anywhere that's, you know, tight and cozy for bats to sneak into and stay safe during the day away from predators. And even sometimes the sides of buildings become habitat. But, you know, old large trees underneath the loose bark, in the foliage, some bats will tuck in behind some of our, like, aspen leaves and our cottonwood leaves, some of those galleries. They'll get in there and just hang out for the day.
They don't hang out with the devil's club leaves, do they?
Oh, yeah. Wow, stinging nettles.
Yes.
But human spaces are very attractive to bats, and that sometimes brings bats into a bit of conflict with humans. Tell us about how you help deal with that and how people can deal with bats in their environment.
Well, that's probably the number one reason people call me. If they get a recommendation to call me, it's because they have bats in their roofs and they want to try to get rid of them or exclude them. And so the first question I always ask is, do you have a metal roof? Because metal roofs are notoriously difficult to exclude bats from because there's so many different ways they can get in. And they only need about 1.5 by 3/4 inch to get into a tight space. And so it can be really hard to exclude them. But what I do try to tell people is the main thing is you don't want to try to block off their use of your roof and between April and September, because what you really would be doing is like entombing them, which doesn't benefit anyone because then you have a bunch of dead bats inside your roof space or your chimney or whatnot. So there's a great website, BatCon, BatCon.org, that has a whole section on bat exclusion that can help give you an idea how to safely and effectively exclude bats if they're a problem for you.
So are bat houses a good idea?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bat houses can be great. A lot of times I tell people, you can't just move bats out of your roof by putting up a bat house. You've got to find a way to effectively exclude them because they're not going to switch, probably. They've found a place they like and just putting up a house won't do it. But they can be great habitat. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about the benefits of having a healthy bat population and not just around a house, but our general area.
Well, bats provide enormous ecosystem services for us. I was looking up some statistics because, you know, I'm a biologist, so that's what we do. And I found it's fascinating to me that a study in 2011 showed that bat consumption of insects reduces the bill for the agricultural industry in the United States by $22.9 billion a year.
By eating pests.
By eating pests. And
the area.
A great example that I found was a study done in the Midwest where they found that one colony of 150 big brown bats annually consumes 600,000 cucumber beetles, 194,000 June beetles, just hundreds of thousands of pests for our crops, agricultural industry.
Go bats.
Go yeah. bats. But no there's bats. Another thing they do, too, and it's something we wouldn't think of.
Pollination?
Yes.
Yeah. Which is, yeah.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, one of the highlights of my career was being able to do mist netting for the two nectar-feeding bats that we have in the United States, the Mexican long-tongued and lesser long-nosed bats. And pulling a bat out of a net and it having pollen all over its face was just one of the most amazing experiences. But yes, they specialize in agave and century plants, other plants in the agave family. So that's why I kind of joked earlier about tequila. If you like tequila, you think a bat.
Oh.
Because that's how agave reproduce pollination, and bats are the primary pollinators there.
And if you want to know the A through Z on how to look at bats and the benefits of fight, FIGHTWNS, fight white nose syndrome, org, and they have a Facebook page as well. Gives the ABCs, literally, all the way down of the benefits to bats.
So,
we've alluded to white nose syndrome again and again, but we haven't really broadly described it. It's a little late, but let's do it. What is it?
So white nose syndrome, we're still learning lots and lots about it. But it is a fungus that actually affects the membranes of bats. And the reason why it's called white nose is because it makes the nose white. But we also see it on the wings. We see it in places where the membranes are very close. They're not furred up. And so it actually dehydrates the cells. So that's why when it was first detected in New York in 2006, part of the reason it was because people were saying in the middle of January and February that bats were eating snow. They were outside eating snow. So there's been a lot of research to it, and we have found it, unfortunately, this last winter, it was detected on the eastern front of Washington.
So it was detected in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Has it been around a long time and just not detected, or did something cause it to emerge?
We don't actually have good backing on that. We know through genetics and through DNA it came from Europe. Mm-hmm. And we know looking at past with Europe that there was a bottleneck in the species in Europe, and they've adapted to it. We don't know exactly if the bottleneck was caused by white nose or a similar type of event, but we know that bats in Europe have adapted and are now living with this fungus. It's a slightly different fungus. There's a little bit of difference in the genetics, but we don't know the cause of it. We don't know if it was a bat that actually came over in crates or if it was spread by people out caving. One thing that we do know is that the fungus can be spread by people. We don't know if it's just the fungus or if it will actually cause the disease, but we do know the fungus can be spread cave to cave and place to place by people. So as a caver, I've changed the complete way of the way I do and go from cave to cave. I don't take the same equipment from cave to cave. If I do, it's completely decontaminated in between.
And I know if you visit many of the national parks in the West, you might find bats, Craters of the Moon, for example, any of the cave systems. Now there's not only a lot of education material, but you can't go in if you've visited another cave, can't wear the same clothes, and they're very strict about enforcing those.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And do they keep folks out during hibernation?
Yes. So like there's a visitor cave in southern Idaho called Minnetonka. Sorry for those listeners. I pronounced that wrong. And it's on the Caribou-Targhee National Forest. And they close it during the winter for hibernation. They also actually have installed different decontamination protocols so that the cave visitors are not taking anything in and not bringing anything out.
So aside from stemming the spread, is there anything else that can be done, is being done, to mitigate its presence?
There's a lot of research being done to try to figure out how to either eliminate the fungus from the cave environment, and they have found that UV does seem to kill the fungus, but finding a practical application for that is always tricky, and they are looking at ways to kind of immunize bats, and they've found some interesting ways to do that by having the presence of other fungus around that kills the fungus that causes white nose.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Do any bats, are any bats cured of white nose, or is it a death sentence?
I don't know that there's a cure, but what we have found is that some bats are more susceptible to white nose in North America. So big brown bats seem to be less susceptible than some of our other bat species, like the little brown bat, which I don't think we mentioned this before, but part of the alarm with white nose syndrome is how rapidly it can reduce a roost population, like by 90%, 100%. So caves back east that maybe had 10,000 bats, they'll go back and there'll be 400 still alive. So it's alarming how high the mortality rate is.
How prevalent is it in our area?
We actually don't have it yet.
That we know.
So, yeah. Let's knock on any wood we can find. But we don't have it yet. It's surrounding us in a lot of ways. Washington, like I mentioned, has it. South Dakota,
Oklahoma. California just had a detection in Northern California.
Yeah. The Wyoming mm-hmm. had a detection. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately it's spreading and potentially coming. Rehabbers have found ways that they can actually bring bats through rehab to feed them and actually bring them. But it's very labor intensive and you have to catch them before it's too late.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you do for your agencies, that the agencies do to help bats in our area.
Well, for myself, for the BLM, I primarily do bat inventory on BLM lands when I can, help with the Abandoned Mine Lands program, which is basically ensuring that mines that we're closing, like if we're physically closing them so there's no longer any type of access, that's not good bat habitat that's occupied. If it is, then we put in grates or gates. So inventory, the Abandoned Mine Lands program, education, that's primarily what I do. And then assessing the effects of projects on bat habitat. If we have timber sales or anything like that, looking at how that timber sale might impact our special status bats especially.
And that's very similar for the Forest Service as well. We do a lot of just inventory monitoring, abandoned caves, or not abandoned caves, abandoned mines program where we close it so we're not entombing any bats.
And I know you both do education. We call mm-hmm. education and outreach events like this, other things, just to spread awareness amongst folks.
Absolutely.
You're right. And bat habitat. So you're not really developing bat habitat. We maybe don't even know what it is entirely.
It can be everything and anything. So we do work with our archaeologists and our engineers if there's something to do with a historical property so that we're maintaining any bat habitat in there, the abandoned mine program or caves, all those things.
Yeah, and I know with just anecdotally, like the abandoned mine program, some of the things that are done include not putting a sealed closure over the abandoned mine so bats can still come and go, and yet mm-hmm. putting something that prevents humans from going into an unsafe situation. So the design and installation of appropriate structures mm-hmm. falls mm-hmm. under probably your review at least, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, at least for the BLM, we do not do any physical closure of mines without having had a bat survey first, which is a tall task because mm-hmm. there are a lot of abandoned mines on BLM. I think the Coeur d'Alene district has several hundred mm-hmm. Abandoned mines mm-hmm. for the Forest Service, so it's a big task.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. preserving habitat to the best of your ability.
In some cases, building it. We mm-hmm. have a BLM, an old historical barn on BLM in eastern Washington that housed a colony of Yuma bats, and the biologist there, Jason Lowe, kudos to Jason Lowe, he actually built more habitat for them.
So National Bat Week.
Yes.
Let's finish with a little bit about National Bat Week.
Well, one thing before that, Phil. Okay. We've mentioned there are 11 bat species, and I think we've referred to, what, three or four? Mm-hmm. Someone run through the list of the 11 bats that we might see, and then on to Bat Week.
Well, we can tag team it. You have most of them here, but we have Myotis aevodus.
Let's do common names.
Yes,
please. So, long-eared.
long-eared, small-footed.
Long-legged.
Townsend Big-Eared.
Yuma Bat.
Little Brown.
Yep. Silver-haired.
Big Brown.
Hoary.
What's that tiny one? Tiny, tiny, or did we catch?
Well, we don't have those up here. Oh, true. But yeah.
Sure. California.
California. Fringed Bat.
I was told that we do have some surveys of a spotted bat.
That would be awesome. One of my favorite bats. Yes, spotted bat would be awesome to find.
You are having a great time.
Let's see. What other?
We did long-legged.
Yeah.
I wasn't counting. I should have started. I should have counted.
Well, they seem to use up most of their fingers. Yeah, right.
So there's one left. Then. So what is Bat Week all about?
It really is an educational week to spread the word about bats, to reduce some of the fears around bats. They can't get into your hair. Mm-hmm. They can detect your hair, for sure. It's to spread the abundance about how important they are as pollinators, as insectivores, as spreading seeds, all those things to show how amazing these creatures are and why it's such a benefit to really look at them. You know, put out a bat house, attract them to your yard so that you use less mosquito repellent, which is better for all of us. And, you know, all those things to really provide that education. So there's quite a few websites and things that will provide good educational material over National Bat Week.
And to help prevent the spread of the white nose syndrome, mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, this has been fabulous. I think we've all learned a lot more about bats today. Thank you for coming on the show. We'll have you back anytime if there's an emerging issue on bats or an update you want to share with us.
My question, my ending question, is a Halloween question. Now that I've learned about the 11 species of bats in northern Idaho, my young dog, my little dog in back, Dexter, has very long ears and very short feet, which I'm confused which bat he's going to be for Halloween. He could be either.
I think he'd be the long-eared bat because he's small, but he has big ears, and that's one of our smaller bats that has big ears. What do you think, Diane?
I agree.
The vampire bat dragging himself across the floor comes to
Well, this has been a great interview. Carrie Hugo and Diane Probasco, thank you so much for joining us on the KRFY Morning Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you both so much.
And if you've just tuned in and missed part of this, you can, as always, listen to a podcast later on about our Bat Week Bat Show. Thank you for tuning in to the Tuesday edition morning show. We're going to segue now out of the interview with a little bit of Meat Loaf, which sounds like an odd thing, but this is from his album, Bat Out of Hell.